This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
Good evening. I'm David Ozenberg, coming to you live from the auditorium at Princeton High School. Tonight is our monthly episode of our very popular What Makes It Great with host, composer, author, commentator, and tonight conductor, Rob Capello. This episode will feature the Symphony No. 8 in B minor, The Unfinished, by Franz Schubert, which Schubert penned in an incomplete fashion at the age of 25, less than 10 years older than the musicians on stage. For performing this will be a select group of talented young musicians, grades 9 through 12, from these area youth orchestras forming this all-area, all-star youth orchestra. Musicians from the Youth Orchestra of Central Jersey, John Henn's music director, find them at yocj.org. The Greater Princeton Youth Orchestra, Kuika Kalahoe, music director, they're found at GPYO, Greater Princeton Youth Orchestra.org. The Youth Orchestra of Bucks County, Robert Lauren, music director, found at YOBC.org. And also musicians from Princeton High School. Mr. Lauren is also director of the orchestras here at the high school. Please welcome the host and creator of What Makes It Great, Rob Capello.
Good evening and welcome to this special edition of What Makes It Great. Before we get started, I'd just like to really take this opportunity to thank the wonderful performers from these three youth orchestras who have taken time out of their incredibly busy schedules, not to mention on an AP exam week, and their three brilliant conductors who have done such a terrific job preparing them. How about a round of applause for the orchestra and their conductors? All right, now how many of you are coming to one of these What Makes It Great programs for the very first time? Show of hands. Wow, fantastic. How many of you have been to one of these before? How many of you are not relatives of someone on stage here? Great. For our listening audience and our newcomers, tonight's program is divided up into three parts. Discussion, demonstration, approximately 60 minutes, where we take the piece apart to within an inch of its life, then an intermission, then a complete performance, which hopefully you'll hear with a whole new pair of ears, and then straight, without pause, into a short question and answer session with myself and the entire orchestra, where you have the rare opportunity of asking anybody on stage anything you like about the program, Schubert, music in general, what these young musicians think about the future of classical music, anything you like. And you will have the rare, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to hear the 20 measures of the unfinished third movement of this piece that Schubert orchestrated and completed before abandoning the symphony, and you can decide if he made the right decision or not. The Q&A is one of the most fun parts, so I hope you'll stay with us to the bitter end. Now, I think it's important to get the biggest disappointment of the evening out of the way right from the start. I'm sure that you think that since, after all, this is a program on Schubert's unfinished symphony, I'm going to tell you why he didn't finish it. The truth is, and I am now saving you hundreds, if not thousands, of pages of reading, the truth is, no one knows why he didn't finish it. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't hundreds of theories, which I'll be happy to discuss with you during the Q&A, but the truth is, no one knows why he didn't finish it. For that matter, no one knows why he didn't finish it, who he wrote it for, or why he wrote it in the first place. All we know for sure is that the manuscript of the two completed movements was dated October 30th, 1822, and that the piece somehow found its way into the hands of Schubert's friend, Anselm Kuttenbrenner, where it remained unknown and unperformed for over 40 years till its first public performance in 1865. It was immediately recognized as a masterpiece. Supposedly, cries of it's Schubert, ran through the hall within moments of the piece beginning, and I'll show you the exact moment where it happened. And it quickly became Schubert's most famous and most frequently performed piece. But why? What makes this piece so great? Schubert, like nearly all 19th century composers, was in awe of Beethoven. And early in his career, he put the problem as bluntly as possible. He said, quote, "Secretly in my heart of hearts, I still hope to make something of myself, but who can do anything after Beethoven?" Though there are conflicting accounts as to whether the two ever actually met, there's no doubt that Beethoven was the dominant imaginative model throughout Schubert's mature artistic career. He was actually a pallbearer at Beethoven's funeral only 20 months before his own. And his dying wish was to be buried as close to Beethoven as possible, which he actually was. However, though on the surface, Schubert's musical procedure seemed to grow directly out of Beethoven, his personality, both musically and personally, was completely different, and the end result is always Schubert and always original. And the opening of the Unfinished Symphony is a perfect example. So to get started, I'm going to have the orchestra play the first 38 measures of this piece as if you were at a normal concert. No talking, no explanation from me, just music. And then we're going to go back and take this opening apart to within an inch of its life to see how Beethoven's influence, always transferred through Schubert's originality, created the opening of this musical universe. So here are the first 38 measures of the Unfinished Symphony.
Terrific, yes.
All right, no matter how many times you've heard the opening eight measures of this piece, it's still an extraordinarily poetic way to begin a symphony. When the cellos and basses play their evocative opening, low in pitch, softly, a single line, without any harmony, we have absolutely no idea what's going on. Is this some kind of a slow introduction? Is it the actual main body of the movement? If it's the main body of the movement, is this a slow movement or a fast movement? Is this actually the main theme of the piece? Maybe because the notes are so low, it's actually a bass line, an accompaniment to the piece. And then, when we get to that ending, these enigmatic last notes that stop the piece dead in its tracks for 9 beats, we have absolutely no idea what's going on. So we're gonna hear these opening 8 bars one more time, and I want you to have all those questions ricocheting in your mind, and I want you to be extremely confused. And if you're not confused, at least look confused, so I'll feel better. So let's hear that opening one more time now, and think about this. What's going on here? Low in pitch, introduction, main theme, slow piece or fast piece? What's going on with this? 9 beats. It just sits there. A truly strange way to begin a symphony. Now, one of the great things about classical music, I often say, is that it's about becoming and not being. What matters often is not what a musical idea sounds like when you first hear it, what it is to be or being, but what it can become over the course of a piece of music. Now, not only do we have no idea what this opening means when we hear it, but after that enigmatic long final note, without explanation, Schubert simply moves on to something else, and it will be 100 measures before we hear that theme again and begin to have any idea what it's all about. It's sort of like having a movie star utter the opening line of a movie and then vanish for 20 minutes for the rest of the film. Now, since there's a moment, as you'll see in a moment, we're really building up this universe bit by bit, I want to show you how Schubert does bit by bit together with you. So sit forward. We're going to have a little theory 101 ear training session here. We're going to start off by playing you just the baseline of what happens in the next passage, since it's the key to the structure. Now, what you're going to hear is a 2-measure pattern plucked pizzicato by the violas, the cellos, the basses, and it's going to repeat several times. Now, I want you to raise your hand at 3 moments as the passage continues. As I say, you'll hear it repeat several times. I want you to raise your hand first when you hear the first note that's outside the pattern. So the first note, just raise your hand, and no one on the radio will know if you're wrong. Then, the second time I want you to raise your hand is when you hear the rhythm stop for a minute, and then they play one note with the bow, and if we get that one wrong, it's going to be a really long night. And then the third time I want you to raise your hand is when the pattern re-begins it again. So you understand your assignment. First time, first note outside the pattern. Second time, one bowed note. Third time, when the pattern begins again. Let's see how you do. Here we go. Here's the pattern. That's it. It repeats several times. You raise your hand when you hear something different. Nervous yet? Next is the bowed note. Oh, phew. Back to the pattern. Not bad. It's always good to start with an example that people get right. Good. Okay, now, that's the basic foundation of what's going on. You've got what goes on top of this in the violins, because it follows the low notes that began the piece, seems at first to be the melody. So when they come in, this sounds like the melody. Now I want to make sure that you're hearing this at the same time as the melody. So one ear for the accompaniment, one ear for the melody. But when you first hear this, you think this is the melody. Now, I want you to notice the subtle pattern changes. The first bar goes like this. If he had copied the next bar higher, it would have simply gone. But instead, it yearns upwards, making a beautiful change. Now, the second bar on the bass line could easily have just simply been this, which would have easily matched the chords above. But his version is subtly dissonant. It's these tiny changes that make the difference between good and great. Now, as I've said, at this point, the violins seem to be the melody, but in a heart-stopping, poignant moment that changes everything, the clarinet and the oboe come in on top of this, and we suddenly see that, in fact, the violins are not the melody, they're the accompaniment, and it's the woodwinds above that are the melody. So I'd like to hear a gasp when the melody comes in the woodwinds. That's the moment when everyone went, oh, it's Schubert, it's Schubert, it's Schubert. You don't have to say that, just gasp. Here we go. So at the beginning, we think they're the melody. Suddenly, it's Schubert. Well done. Suddenly, we move to major. We try to get to major. We get there. But no! We try again. Add a yearning horn. Try to move forward again. But no! Try a third time. 5 measures this time. Exactly where we started. B minor, we've gone nowhere. All movement is blocked. We arrive here, and we started the piece here. We've gone absolutely nowhere. Yet sometimes in music, as in life, when all roads seem blocked, another possibility emerges simply by looking in a new way at what was already there. In a magical moment, Schubert takes a single note outside of its normal context. We get here, he removes all the notes except one note, reduces the orchestra to a single note, and then he thinks out loud. Can I hear this note in some new way, going in a different direction? And then in a beautiful moment of discovery, the horns and the bassoons take this note in a completely unexpected direction, and we suddenly arrive in a major key world, completely free of the anxiety and sorrow of this minor key opening. Here's the magic moment, a single note. Where can we take it? Think out loud. Where can I go? A light bulb goes off. Suddenly, major. truly extraordinary moment. You know, in a famous dream that Schubert recorded in his diary, the exact same year as he wrote the Unfinished Symphony, he wrote, quote, "Whenever I attempted to sing of love, it turned to pain. And again, when I tried to sing of pain, it turned to love. Thus were love and pain divided in me." And some of the most poignant moments in Schubert are these heartrending alternations between major and minor keys, between love and pain. There's somehow a sense for Schubert that they're two different sides of the same reality, always capable of transforming in an instant from one to another, as if we're honest, they are in our own closest relationships. And for an instant, in one of the world's most famous melodies, we have pure happiness, but as always in Schubert, only for a moment. Did the cellos play that beautifully? Yes. This is probably Schubert's most famous melody in the entire world. Now, it begins with a simple leap down. He could have easily balanced it with leap up. But instead, he adds one note with that fantastic rhythm, not, but a long, short, long. One fantastic rhythm. Then he repeats it, but adds more, continuing the plot. But always back to leap. So much of Schubert is about trying to move forward in life, but always having all your forward momentum poignantly thwarted. You always keep coming back to leap down. Then he starts to repeat the whole thing a second time. Leap down and three notes up. But instead of continuing like the first time, he now goes higher, trying to move forward. Stays higher, but then sadly, minor, lower, and back to leap down. All roads lead back to leap down. Now, I want you to sing just the ending of that, and you'll see why in a minute. Just sing the la, 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 go. Good, now keep that in mind, and listen to what the violins play when they repeat the melody, and the ending is heartbreaking. So I want to make sure you're all expecting this at the end. And I'll know if you are. Okay, here we go. Leap down, then three notes up, and three notes up, but back to leap down. The repeat, the higher version. Watch this. What an amazing moment. In a stunning poetic stroke, the melody, hope, beauty, simply dissolves. All of a sudden, what you sang so beautifully loses its last note and gets reduced to just. The whole audience is dying for. But no! Becomes just. And after a seemingly endless, poignant pause, the melody actually gets to resolve to the missing note, but now it's part of a completely different world. Moment of pure melody has vanished. Just as Schubert said in his dream, quote, "Whenever I attempted to sing of love, it turned to pain." But for Schubert, not only can love and pain alternate in an instant, the same musical idea can contain both possibilities. 10 measures later, the lovely ending of the melody's first half, which went like this. I want you to sing la 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 la. Ready, sing. Now get rid of the last note. Ready, go. Now clap that rhythm. Ready, go. And that rhythm now becomes a 12-measure obsession. Every single measure uses that idea, its rhythm and its shape, and it takes it into ever more turbulent emotional landscapes. So that lovely melody you heard a moment ago now turns into this. More
forceful.
As I said, great music is about becoming and not being. Meaning, in a way, unfolds gradually. Musical ideas, so to speak, gain weight as a piece progresses. 10 measures later, this turbulent music is followed by a completely new lyrical version of that second theme to add the section. Now, it begins exactly the same with our famous lead down and three notes up. But instead of continuing like the first time, now it blooms up here. At the same moment, the cellos enter with the beginning of the theme underneath it. And then all the parts bloom to create a completely brand new ending. Creating this beautiful, subtly asymmetrical five-bar phrase, all out of that simple idea. Now it turns into this. Violins. Seconds. Cellos. They bloom. The woodwinds do it in heaven. Now, at this point, we need to talk about something that's actually been lurking in the background, not only of tonight's program, but the entire What Makes a Great series. Something that I've called in my first book, which I'm sure you've read and know by heart, what I've called the challenge of memory. You know, though it's rarely conscious, every work of art, from the simplest comic book or pop song to the most complex work of modernist poetry or avant-garde music, embeds within its content, within its notes or words, a belief about who its audience is and what they will or won't be able to follow. Television and film writers assume that audiences and viewers will be able to effortlessly follow film and plot developments over the course of a 1, 2, or even a 3-hour film or program. A little comment made by a witness in the opening scene of a Law and Order episode on television might turn out to be the key to solving a murder in a way that only becomes clear in the final hour of the program, in the last scene. Similarly, composers assume that listeners will be able to follow and remember musical plot developments over the course of a movement or possibly even an entire piece. In his book, What to Listen for in Music, Aaron Copland succinctly describes what I have called the challenge of memory like this. He says, "It is insufficient merely to hear music in terms of the separate moments at which it exists. You must be able to relate what you hear at any given moment to what has just happened before and what is about to come afterward. However, to follow what happens to a musical idea over the course of a movement requires remembering in minute 6 what a musical idea sounded like in minute 1, 2, 3, and 4, and noticing the difference, which, let's be honest, is much more difficult for nearly everyone on the planet than remembering television and film plots. But no worries, we are here to help." One of the startling things about this piece up to this moment is the fact that that evocative opening for the cellos and the basses has literally vanished from the piece for 100 measures. Though its presence hovered mysteriously over the opening for some period of time, by now it's probably been forgotten by everybody but the most attentive listener, but it has not been forgotten by Schubert. Now, I want you to remember, the opening version began on a B. You don't have to know names of notes for tonight's program. Just think of it as a label and remember that the opening begins on a B. So if I ask you 10 minutes from now, what note does the opening begin on, you will say B. And everyone in the radio audience will be so amazed. Okay, good. Now, just in case you've forgotten, we're going to remind you of what that opening sounded like the first time. Here was the opening of the piece beginning on a B. Here we go. Get it in your ear, memorize it. The 9 long beats. That's what it sounds like at the beginning of the piece. It returns to open the development section, the middle section of this piece, 100 measures later, and now it starts on an E. If it had copied the opening exactly, it would have sounded like this. This is what the challenge of memory is all about. Here's an exact copy, simply starting on an E. Expect this, memorize it. Got it in your ear, yes? The answer is always yes, by the way.
Yeah.
Good, good, good. But now, listen to what it does instead. I want you to raise your hand the instant you hear a change. Really expect that at the end. Here's what happens instead. Gasps are always appropriate. No way. I don't believe it. I mean, that is a truly, truly stunning moment. Now, the poet Novalis says that the purpose of all romanticism is to, quote, make the familiar strange and the strange familiar. Now, by itself, it's just a scale. That's familiar. It's anything but strange. But expecting this, and instead getting this, each note, lower, lower, your jaw is a little bit more open. This note is so low that double basses can't actually play it. They need an extra string or an extension to actually play this note. We are down in another region that no one has ever visited before. So definitely during the performance, please gasp when we get to that extraordinary moment. All right, now, this is what it's like to make the familiar strange and the strange familiar. Now, what comes above this over here is absolutely amazing. It's Beethoven's compositional technique put to completely different expressive purposes. The cellos and the basses, as you just heard, worked with the end of the idea, the long note, and turned it into that long scale. The upper strings now work with the beginning of the idea. Now I want you to sing the original version of the opening four notes like this. La, 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 la. You sing. Now what all he does is he changes the ending and adds this wonderfully expressive two-note sigh at the end instead. Here's what he does instead. Expect this. If you don't expect it, there's no magic. Here we go. Now that's the kind of reaction I want to hear. Fantastic. And then, since you got such a good reaction, he does it a second time. Now, watch this. This is pure Beethoven. Now, we have that new two-note sigh. He gets rid of the beginning and works with just the new part, just the two-note sigh, and does a D of the two-note sigh higher like this. And then one more time, still higher. Now, while this is going on, the violas and the bassoons are echoing this idea, making a little round, and the cellos and the basses are providing the shuddering, mysterious foundation. So listen to this passage now. All it is taking the opening and changing it to... You are an excellent audience. Okay, here we go. Let's try it with them. Around. They do it again. They sigh. Around. Now just the sigh. Higher. Can you believe I stopped it right there? All right, you can't clap, but we're not nearly done. This is an amazing plot. What comes next comes right out of Beethoven. Having worked with the various parts of the theme, he now reduces the whole theme to its essence, its core essence. Sing me the opening four notes. I'll play them for you one more time on la. You sing again. Now get rid of the last note. Ready, sing. We're gonna call this three, notes up, for obvious reasons, since it's three notes up. He now reduces the entire piece to nothing but the first three notes of the symphony. Three notes up. You're going to hear the horn play those three notes up over and over again, shifting the rhythm and gradually making it shorter until finally three notes up will become nothing more than three notes up, three notes up, three notes up. The essence of the universe right in your face in the French horns. Here's what they play. Three notes up, three notes. Change the rhythm. Three notes up, three notes up. Short now. Three notes up, three notes up, three notes up. Okay, we're now at the center of the universe. The whole piece has been reduced to its opening three notes up. Now, what can you do with a musical idea? Whether you know anything about music, what do you think an upside-down version of three notes up with down replacing up would be? Three notes down, which is what the violins and oboes play. Three notes down, three notes down. We're gonna put those two parts together, and it's like looking at yourself in the mirror. One half of you is going up, the other half is going down. Here, just those two parts together. But these aren't just notes. This is the opening three notes of the symphony. The whole world reduced to three notes like this. Three. You've got the basic elements. We're going to play that whole entire passage for you so you can really feel what it's like for Schubert to build this up for you in real time. Yet, and this is the key moment, yet just as we're on the verge of a Beethovenian explanation of the entire universe, having reduced everything to three notes up, three notes up, Beethoven would definitely have reduced everything to three, 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 three. But not Schubert. Schubert simply heads off in another direction. So here's that whole passage. Now remember, it all depends, the challenge of memory, on you remembering that opening version 100 measures earlier, gasping when they start their scale, being amazed that they turn the opening idea into this, and following the entire narrative that we just described. So I want to see new ears on all of you. Here we go. This is the opening. Here's the change. The scale that goes down into the depths. Start from nowhere. The change, the end. The sigh. Just the sigh higher. Sigh higher. The three notes. Part of the reason that so many Schubert masterpieces feel so long, kindly critics call it his heavenly length, is there such a profusion of variations, so many subplots to be explored, rather than the relentless narrative drive of Beethoven. In Schubert, there's no single answer, no single version that all of the other versions ultimately reduce to. In Schubert, there are no absolute truths, only relative truths. Okay, so we've now seen that opening turn into this by changing its ending. We now get another new powerful version, and all we do is change the fourth note. The power of a single change. So expect this, and listen to him change the fourth note in the trombones, cellos, and basses, like this. Change, transpose, do it lower. Now, by itself, that variation is pretty simple. All you do is change the fourth note. But listen to it with swirling strings above it and an answering echo in the woodwinds. Who would have ever guessed that this teeny little could possibly become this? If we had known she was going to become this, we would have never married her in the first place. Now remember, this is that tiny opening theme. Now it turns into this. Now, after many more developments that we'll save for the performance and a repeat of the entire exposition, the opening theme ultimately returns to begin the last section of the movement, the coda. And once again, it seems like there will be a final resolution. Now, what note did we say that this theme originally began on?
B.
A B, excellent. But just in case the radio audience isn't quite that smart, let's remind them of that opening one more time. Here's what it sounded like on a B, and particularly pay attention to those long 9 beats at the end on a single note. Here was the beginning. Here's the 9 beats. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay, now, it actually hasn't been heard beginning on this note since the opening measure of the piece. Since all the other versions in all the other sections of the piece began on different notes, and Schubert omitted these opening 8 measures in the recapitulation, it now comes back on a B for the first time in 220 measures. This is what I mean by the challenge of memory, and in a simple poetic stroke, it seems to resolve itself by simply adding chords at the end instead of holding for 9 beats at the end. So here's the moment where it all resolves itself. Now, 220 measures later, back on a B. Instead of holding, we resolve. Now, having resolved the ending of the theme, that little ending moment, this with chords on top, we now resolve the beginning. Remember those opening 3 notes? They repeat 6 times as part of a simple cadence with varied instrumentation. And just when you think the piece is about to be done, we've heard those opening notes on the original pitches 6 times, 3 violin chords refuse to submit. And then in a quintessentially Schubertian poetic moment, a Beethoven technique infused with Schubertian poetry, having reduced the whole piece to its opening 3 notes, he finally reduces it to just the first note, which shudders into silence, to end the entire movement. So here's the fantastic ending of the entire first movement. First 3 notes 6 times. First time. Second time. Third time. The original instruments. But suddenly, that note is?
B.
B. Fantastic. A hand. An extraordinary ending to an extraordinary movement. And the second movement is just as extraordinary. Its opening is as intimate and as lyrical as any symphony opening in the entire literature. In a way, it begins with a sigh, a kind of a breath in, a breath out in the bassoons and horns over pluck, 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 pizzicato in the double basses alone. So we will call this idea pluck, 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 side. That's not exactly technical vocabulary, and I wouldn't use it outside of this room, but we'll refer to this opening as pluck, 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 side. So here's the opening of the second movement. Main theme. Back to pluck, pluck, side. Change direction to minor. A shudder and a cadence. Back to pluck, 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 a higher octave. That's the opening. Now, as I said, it begins with a sigh over pluck, pluck, pluck. When the beautiful main theme begins, it's hard to say who actually has the melody. Is it the singing cello line, or is it the violin line above it? Back to pluck, 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 side. Now, the first time went step up, then a little arpeggio. For non-musicians, if this is a chord, three notes at once, arpeggio is just one at a time. That's arpeggio. So first time went step up, arpeggio, step up. Second time, step up, arpeggio, step down, which takes us to a minor key. We get one little shudder, and then we make a cadence with the only fast notes in the phrase. Remember those? Those will always return to make our cadence. Now then, the truth is, I lied. I actually had them play this and resolve in a major key. But the truth is, that's not what actually happens. As is so often the case, remember his diary. Whenever I attempted to sing of love, it turned to pain. He instead turns to minor, leading to multiple fluidly changing versions of this opening theme. Now, we've already heard two different versions that begin in a major key. We've heard step up, back to the same note, arpeggio, step up. Step up, back to the same note, arpeggio, step down. We now hear two more, the first one beginning in minor. But here's the real connector, not the version I cheated on that went to major, but here's Schubert's version. Minor. Viola. A new version. Out of our arpeggio and our fast notes. Arpeggio decorated. Now, after a brief majestic interlude, the opening music returns to transition magically to one of the most exquisite and poignant themes that Schubert or anyone else in the world has ever written, the heart-rending second theme in the clarinet. This is my favorite moment of the entire life, and if you don't like this, you will never like me. So here is the wonderful transition, and then the beginning of the second theme in the clarinet, one of the great clarinet moments in the entire literature, no pressure on her whatsoever. Here we go. Transition. An octave lower. You hold your breath. No one breathes. Suddenly, didn't she do a fantastic job? Yes. Like the first movement, the transition to this beautiful second theme is stunningly intimate, and it begins by taking a single note and isolating it. We finish pluck, 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 sigh, and we isolate one note. And that's one of those beautiful moments where literally no one can breathe for four measures. The violins play this note. Now, this is so subtle. We think it's part of this chord that we just ended with. The next note should be this. But instead, remember, love and pain. This goes surprisingly to here. Suddenly we're in minor. Now, the accompaniment has a syncopated energy that gives the entire passage its energy like this. Every single note is off the beat in the accompaniment. Now, at heart, the opening of the melody in the clarinet is ridiculously simple. It's just this, done higher, done higher, done higher. I mean, by itself, that couldn't be more plain. But stretched out with a throbbing accompaniment underneath, it becomes this. Now, one note makes all the difference. He could have kept the accompaniment like this. He changes only one note. That one note is the difference between good and great. Then does it higher. Again, one note is different. Now, the motion starts to speed up in both the accompaniment and the melody itself. And then, as the clarinet holds this one note, this A, the accompaniment journeys to a stunningly remote harmonic region. Listen to this amazing moment. The clarinet is doing nothing but holding a single note, and the accompaniment is going here. Somehow we have found ourselves in Tahiti. We have no idea how we ever got here, but it's an amazing moment. Now, while that clarinet is holding that one note A, six different chords have been underneath that one note. It's been this, it's been this, it's been this, 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 and then this. All while she's holding that one note. You know that Wallace Stevens poem, 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird? This is six ways of looking at an A. Just sits there. Suddenly we are in this remote region we have never been to before. Violas make one great change. We do it lower. And once again, we think out loud, where could I go with this note? One incredible pain-filled note in the first violins. And then we head for a minor key resolution. And here's the best part. Everyone in the room expects it to go and to stay in minor. Get that in your ear. I want you to expect this with every fiber of your being. But here's what happens instead. One may, and he marks it pianissimo. One P means piano, soft. Two P's, pianissimo, very soft. This is a special marking. Three P's, pianissimo, absolutely inaudible as we have that heartbreaking moment while we change to major. But remember, as magical as this moment is, and the theme is, remember, great art is about becoming, not being, about what an idea can become, not simply what it is. And he then takes that haunting minor key opening that went like this, we'll remind you of it. Here was the minor key opening. And now he transforms it in heartbreaking fashion into a major key with the oboe and adds a new line underneath in the cello like this. A new ending. Third time. Ezra Pound says that genius is the capacity to see 10 things where the ordinary man sees one, and the completely different emotional worlds that Schubert is able to find in this one clarinet theme are extraordinary. You've already heard that haunting, intimate, minor key version that began like this. you hear the wonderful, exquisite major key version in the oboe that began like this. A moment later, the idea completely transforms fortissimo into a stern, harsh, immensely dramatic version in the trombone, cello, and bass. Now, this is that same theme. Remember, this is what you just heard as. Here's just the theme in those instruments. Now with the full orchestra, that intimate theme becomes this overwhelmingly dramatic version. So really get it. This started as this. And now it turns into this amazingly dramatic version. Their technique often looks similar. Development meant two very different things to Beethoven and Schubert. For Beethoven, Beethoven's developments of a musical idea always attempt to get closer and closer to its essence, to strip away the inessential and get at the core meaning of a musical idea. Schubert's developments lack this kind of fanatical directedness. It's more discursive. There's not that relentless sense of trying to get to a definitive, final version of an idea. For Schubert, every new development is simply an opportunity to see a new view, an other vista on an endless road. We've already heard our opening pluck, pluck, sigh several times. We've heard it down low, resolving in major. We've heard it an octave higher, resolving in minor. But it's always been two measures long, and it's always been simply a three-note scale, six plucks, and a resolution. Now in the coda, we get a completely new version that not only drastically alters the basic shape, but expands that two bars to six bars, turning it into a complete phrase with a cadence at the end. So expect this, one, two, three, four, five, six, stop, and here's what happens in the coda. One, two, three, four. And it keeps going. It just keeps going. And a new ending then does it an octave lower. And one final astonishing passage leads to the end of the entire piece. As the phrase that you just heard cadences like this, Schubert once again removes a single note from the chord, pianissimo in the violins, leading to one of those stunningly intimate hold your breath moments that only Schubert was able to create like this. It's always been four measures. He adds two more. Where are we? The opening theme. But without the cello line underneath. How will we ever get home from this remote key? Schubert shockingly returns to that naked first violin moment a second time, but now a half step higher. Not here, but now up here. An exact copy would take us even farther afield harmonically, someplace that not even Google Maps could ever find its way back from. But he somehow subtly alters the violin figure to return to the home key and lead to the peaceful conclusion of the entire piece. So the first version was down here. We now do it a half step higher up here. the main theme, without a cello line, are fast notes. One horn plays the arpeggio, the fast notes. Two horns, just the fast notes. Just a quick final thought and we'll take our intermission. The emotional world of the unfinished symphony, beautiful as it is, seems at heart deeply sorrowful, and this quality hovers everywhere over Schubert's tragically short and difficult life. He died almost unknown outside Viennese musical circles at the age of 31. And he talks about this sorrow in two poignant letters. Quote, "All I have created is born of my understanding of music and my own sorrow. That which is engendered by grief alone seems to please the world least of all." And then second, "I feel myself the most unfortunate, the most miserable being in the world. Each night when I go to sleep, I hope never again to wake, and each morning merely reminds me of the misery of yesterday." Yet for all the sadness and despair, Schubert's music is also filled with astonishing bursts of joy and beauty. And thinking about this paradox led me to a final quote that I want to share with you from the brilliant writer on mythology, Joseph Campbell. He describes what's traditionally called the first noble truth of Buddhism as the realization that everything in life is impermanent. Because nothing lasts, and everything, ourselves included, is impermanent, all life, according to the Buddha, is inherently sorrowful. But, Campbell says, and I think this is such a lovely thought and such an important thought at this moment in our country's history, which is so filled with polarization and division, he says, we can choose to participate joyfully in the sorrows of the world. And so the final image I want to leave you with before you hear this piece after intermission is an image of Schubert, intimate with grief and despair, but always alive in every note and measure to the possibility of hope and melody. Schubert, the poet of impermanence. Schubert, joyfully participating in the sorrows of the world. Thank you and enjoy the performance.
Capello and this all-star youth orchestra made up of select members of youth orchestras from this area, the Youth Orchestra of Central Jersey, John Ann's music director, the Greater Princeton Youth Orchestra, Kawika Kalahoi, music director, Youth Orchestra of Bucks County, Robert Lauren, music director. I'm David Ozenberg. We'll be back in a few minutes with a complete performance of the Symphony No. 8 in B minor, The Unfinished by Franz Schubert, followed by a Q&A with the audience here at Princeton High School. We're going to spend a few minutes here at intermission chatting with the three music directors of the three youth orchestra organizations featured here this evening. This, What Makes It Great, is an exclusive production of the award-winning Classical Network and WWFM.org.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of our Live from Princeton, What Makes It Great, which was recorded just this past Monday at Princeton High School. As I mentioned to those in attendance, programs like What Makes It Great only happen on the Classical Network through the support of those who are members of the Classical Network. If you are a fan of What Makes It Great and Rob Capello, we need your support to make it continue. If you are enjoying this particular episode where Rob, who normally works with professional musicians of the highest caliber, agreed to do this program with these young musicians whose whole music-making career is ahead of them, then we need to hear from you to support programming and decisions like this. If you're listening to this for the first time, perhaps you are related or know one of the young musicians on stage, and you're hearing what what an incredible program this is, we ask you for your support. Go to our website, wwfm.org, and make a donation in membership to ensure that we can continue to bring you programs such as this. We'll be back in a moment with a short chat with the three music directors of the three youth orchestra organizations participating in this very special What Makes It Great.